You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Kia ora, my name is Jamie Hanton, and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Based in central Christchurch since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to achieve a higher level of professional and creative development and encourage a greater acknowledgement, understanding, and value of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. Welcome to episode 17 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we have a special double feature. First up, we have Nina Oberg-Humphreys discussing her current exhibition, Ta'ai, on now at the Physics Room. Following Nina, Wellington-based audio describer and visitor services host at Te Papa, Judith Jones has created an audio described tour of Ta'ai for blind and low vision audiences. It's a 13-minute description of the key visual elements, which may also be of interest to those of you who haven't been able to visit the exhibition yet, or who are interested in hearing audio description in action. Christchurch-born and bred, Nina is of Cook Islands and Pākehā descent, and graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts, majoring in sculpture from Ilam School of Fine Arts in 2018. Her work explores her dual Pacific and Western heritage, as she seeks to convey issues of gender, identity, and social politics through the use of traditional Polynesian art forms combined with elements of popular culture. Nina is the 2020 Creative New Zealand University of Canterbury Macmillan Brown Centre for Pacific Studies Artist in Residence, and Ta'ai is the result of the ongoing partnership between the Physics Room and the Macmillan Brown Centre for Pacific Studies to present work and research produced during this residency. In Samoan, Ta'ai is the action of binding. It is also the word scratched onto the surface of an awa ipu, kava cup, as part of the Oldman collection housed in the Canterbury Museum. During her residency, Nina examined items from the Oldman collection and invited members of Canterbury's Pacific community to engage with them, to recall memories and stories of their experiences of living in or growing up in Aotearoa. These stories are encoded in the recreation of a god staff and video work, where the act of wrapping and feather adornment are central to connecting and containing the mana of relationships past, present, and future. We now join Nina in the gallery space discussing her work. Welcome, Nina. Thank you so much for all your work this week. It's been really amazing working with you, finally, after all this time knowing each other, to have the show on here. I'm super proud. This is an outcome from the Creative New Zealand University of Canterbury Macmillan Brown Centre for Pacific Studies Arts in Residence for 2020. And I thought we'd just start the talk with a little bit of an introduction to the research you did in the residency. Maybe you could tell us about the proposal that you put forward for the residency and how this year's kind of played out in that respect, and then we'll come to the outcome of the show.
Kia ora, everybody. Nina Oberg-Humphreys, for those of you that don't know me. I come from a beautiful lineage of ancestors that stretch back to Rarotonga, Ruamanga, Matawira. Born and bred in Christchurch, married to a beautiful Samoan man, and have two lovely little kitties that are running around and keep me very grounded. I'm a multimedia artist living here in Christchurch. All my work revolves around what it looks like to be a second-generation New Zealand-born Pacific person living here in Christchurch. Over the last couple of years, I've been working with the museum, Canterbury Museum, and items that are in their collection. Canterbury Museum has over 10,000 Pacific items in their storehouse, and only 5 are on display. So if you have all these items out, when will we ever see them? Growing up in the city, it's particularly its architecture, you know, everything's very white. And where do you find yourself here as, I guess, an other? So this collection became really important to me, being able to have, I guess, a direct link from myself to that collection in the city, knowing it was in the storehouse. But then it made me think, well, if I know that this stuff is here, and I've had this amazing privilege of going out to the storerooms and looking through things and being able to, you know, touch stuff and ask questions, or, you know, just see the beautiful taonga which comes from our people, then there is a whole bunch of us that really miss out on this experience. So I've been working with Canterbury Museum in the last couple of years to get items out on display. And that started with working with Skate Public Arts Trust, putting items in from the collection, bringing them out into the museum's foyer and having a display, to having them in our local library so that people can see them. Very limited objects, you know, you might get 24, be able to have 24, because, you know, there's things like insurance that you have to deal with. But the impact that it had on people was huge. Kids coming in saying, oh, you know, where's this from? Where's this made? Oh, Tonga, oh, wow. And then having this direct link, because a lot of them had never gone back to their homelands. And so when it came to the McMillan Brown Artisan Residency, growing up, it was a really important part of my makeup. When a McMillan Brown artist came, it felt like there was something special going on, because there was very little art, very little Pacific experience, and as a young person, I was desperate to cling on to something. And so when someone came and was in this residency, it really did feel special, and so it's been a very important thing for me. And I've applied like 5 times. You know, I was like, maybe this one will work. But it came back to the items, and that was the start of the research. Was I had this experience working with these items, and it was like, well, there's so much beautiful things out there. Well, in that place, how do we get them out? How do we share them? How do I get people to look at them? And that was really the project. And so I chose a collection bought by the New Zealand government in 1948 called the Oldman Collection. And the Oldman Collection is one of the best, I'd say even the best, collection of Pacific examples. And when it was bought, it was from W.O. Oldman, there's like hardly anything written about him. He was a prolific collector, a wheeler dealer, who never set foot in the Pacific or this side of the world, but had this ginormous collection of Māori and Pacific items. And in this collection as well, 95% of it are from the London Missionary Society. And so when it was bought, all the Māori artefacts went to what is now Te Papa, and the Pacific works were separated between four main centres. And the best examples and most of the collection actually came down to the South Island, because Roger Duff, who bought the collection at the time, was working at Canterbury Museum and then went down to Dunedin. And so most of this collection is in the South Island. Yeah, it's like, you know, there's no one here to see it. I mean, Dunedin, they've been quite good with their collection. They have a whole display which is dedicated to Pacific works, but we don't have anything here. And they're some of the best examples in the world. And there's in this collection as well, there's two spiritual items. Well, there's a lot of spiritual items, but two feather gods from the Cook Islands, and they're tapu beyond tapu, and there's not any around. They've come here by chance, and the rest all live in the British Museum, and there's a handful of those. And so I got these, basically what I did is I thought, well, look at these items, I want to get these things out, but I want other people to experience them. And I'm interested in what relevance do these items have to people that have never had anything to do with them? Do they know anything about them through stories in which they've had through their life? Is there some kind of, I guess, inherent memory there that's connected to these items? And so I asked people from the local community to come in and look at a very small collection that was chosen. Literally, there's a list, and it's like staff, Samoa, cup, Fiji. You know, that's the list of items. went along and ticked some and went, okay, well, we'll see what we get. And there was 37 objects that we got out from a variety of places. We had Easter Island, the Marquesas, the Cook Islands, Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, Niue, and Tokelau. And then I asked people from the community to come in and basically let's have a conversation. And I had 10 people that came in and looked at the physical items. And then I had a number of other conversations through a beautiful catalogue, which is the Oldman Collection catalogue. Because this residency all started during lockdown. So it was a bit like, well, how am I going to do this thing? And they were like, you know, we'll defer it to next year. And I was like, no, we're just going to do it. Because if this is the world, then we're just going to figure out how we're going to do this. So a lot of the conversation started with, well, I'll scan this page and send it to you. Which was interesting again, because you know, how do we make spiritual connections to things through a digital world? So people came in and I had members of the community from all different places, parents and their children, migrants to kind of second generation New Zealanders, people that had never gone back to or had never been to the places in which they connect to, people who had come, and it's been very, very recent migration. And it was a beautiful experience. People came in and you really felt the connection, the deepness, the openness. It was like people came in and it was like finding home. It really was. I get emotional because it's like, you know, one man came in and he just cried. He came in, he saw a box that reminded him of his father and he just cried. You know, it was an hour of just deep emotion. And we left each other feeling like we had connected like no time before. But also it was like some healing experience for him. And that happened through seeing an object that reminded him that, you know, his father never owned it, but just went, oh, that's my dad. Or parents and their kids talking for the first time about why I came to New Zealand, you know, becoming completely isolated. And then their kids basically talking for the first time about what that isolation or has done to them, being in the world or not having culture and language passed on to them, and talking about how what their parents had gone through in terms of being here, but also how where they were at, and then having this beautiful conversation about all these things. So it brung up lots of stuff. We had about an hour and a half with each group, and even that's a bit ridiculous, but we had one weekend. And, you know, even that, you have to get special tick boxes to be able to see things that belong to you, really, and you get very limited time, and you can't touch them, and you can't, you know, there's all these issues.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Basically, from there was some real core themes coming out. And they were of people coming here and just protecting themselves, you know? They needed to assimilate, they needed to get on with things, they needed to go get jobs, they needed to learn English, they needed to do that, they needed to fit in, they needed to be the good strange person. And they wrapped themselves in protection to do that and to get on with stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. And then we have this other side of people that have been born here or that really miss cultural connections or feel isolated, and they just want to be wrapped up and they want to be bound up and they want to feel their culture, they want to know their language, they want to learn as much as possible, they want, you know, accessibility to it. And then there were the physical items. Every single one of these items had this deep relationship, be it through geometric pattern, be it through the making process, be it through the actual physical, you know, the woods, the plating, anything. They had this real relationship of binding. And then not only that, there were two items that were looked at, like no others, and they were a kava cup, an ava'ipu from Samoa, and a bale from Samoa, which is like a headband that goes around here. These were the only items that were related to, like, direct to the face. People were really interested in this, and we got these two items out, and, you know, we became detectives, and we got magnifying glasses and things, and these items had never been looked at. There's, you know, there's no information, not about what they're made out of, nothing, just nothing, no information. So we was like, well, what can we find out about this? And then as we were going around with this cup, etched in it was Ta'ai Fau, which is when in... sought some advice afterwards and went, what does this word mean, to lots of Samoan people. And they explained it as ta'ai as being the action of wrapping, and fau like to build. So it was like to build, to wrap and to build. And I saw that as relationships, because, you know, carve a cup and pass around to people. But then also other people saying, well, Ta'ai is a chief name, it's in the Thai name. So it could be a very different thing. Or is this a tourist item? You know, who knows? So the thing from there was, well, if we have these items that we can't get information about, you know, there's these items in there that no one knows anything about other than that's from the Cook Islands, and this is what we did, and, you know, but there's not a lot of why it was made, what it was used for, you know, all these kinds of things. Is you just know that there's some kind of connection here, and you have a real growing population, and there's this the act of protection, and we can't find things. You know, if you don't know your whakapapa, if you don't know where you came from, if you don't know or have people around you that you feel comfortable to talk to about these things, or it becomes harder to get, what do you do to create a sense of yourself? You know, because you can't just kind of walk around feeling lost all the time. It creates problems. And, you know, so we get told all the time by everyone that the more you know about your identity, the better you will feel about yourself, the more that your well-being, you know, economic outcomes, all that stuff. But if you've got nowhere to find this stuff, and the items that can help you do this are in a box over there that you can't get to because there's no access to it, then what do? And I guess that I thought, well, you make new ones. And that this show is about that. It's about, if you don't feel like you have the language to partake in conversations about you and your people and how you move forward, and you feel whakamā or embarrassed about how you can put yourself in a point of leadership, you just do it. Because no one can tell you that you're wrong and right because of how you feel of your sense of identity or where it is that you belong. Or that because you don't know the line of people that stretches back hundreds of years and connects to a mountain doesn't mean that you don't belong in that place. And I guess that that's where it's very difficult because, you know, even being here is like with tongues of whenua, we know that we're related. There's a lot of similarities, but it's a hard negotiation as to where it is that Pacific peoples fit in. And so these items were a way of being able to express all those stories that are centred on feather gods, which people would have. They'd have them personally or in their homes in the Cook Islands. You know, there's hardly any of them around. And people would have them, and they were very spiritual items, a god staff. Again, that would be wrapped in meters and meters, hundreds of meters of tapa. and that was your art tour. And when there was a problem, they would unwrap the tapa and see if there was any damage to the tapa. And if there was, they would, you know, patch it up, make sure there's no mould, wrap it back up, and tie it back up. And so therefore it was a way of, oh, okay, well, everything should be good now. And so the needing to make new ones, well, if I can't understand this, I don't have access, then what kind of things do I know in myself that can bring out and connect to the same way in which these items were made? So I got what I had, when I found things that I'm a magpie. When I found things that I had, things that I associate with making, well, Pacific culture. I learned how to cut grapes from my Kogan's auntie in Auckland. It said, oh, no, you just get the grapes, you know, and you cut them and you put them on your olas and, you know, all the feathers and beads and shiny things. Like, yeah, that's really what I'm about. But also so how do you lift something where it's all, you know, the material's so accessible, but how do you lift it to a spiritual place? And then, so the items in which I used became really important, the materiality, but then also the making. So these, you look at these items and you think, oh, well, how were these made? And you have an assumption that there was karakia or some kind of chanting something when they were being made. And so when I was making them, I was doing the same thing, and I wished all the people that were part of this process well, took my time with them, and that's really how we got these two works. And the one around the corner, the film, I filmed it twice actually. I had some guys the first time, I just kind of walked away from it and looked at the footage and things and went, oh no, that's just not really working for me. And so I got some young people that I know, and they came along and I talked to them about the project. I talked to them about the items, we looked at photographs, I talked to them about the themes in which I was thinking about, and I said, this is my idea, and they were really like, okay, cool. And two of them are family. So the woman, Victoria, who's pulling the rope, two cousin in the centre, and I really thought of that as, well, sometimes you just kind of, you are the God stick. You are all the things that, your experiences and things that you deal with, and trying to find your base or your balance in the world, particularly as a young person. And I really feel as a young Pacific man, and you know, he's been bound up by his cousin who really took enjoyment out of doing that. And it seems that every take we did, she started doing it tighter and tighter and tighter. And the first question was like, oh, did that hurt?
And you didn't unbound it.
No, we left him in there for a while. He's a chief kid. You know, it's really hard to find your place. And sometimes, I think, especially through these conversations, you can feel really oppressed by that mission. You know, it's heavy, heavy stuff. But you do it, and you keep your ground, and you stand up to it, and you come out the other side being whoever you are. And so that was the film, really. I think I've talked a lot.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Nina, I'm curious about the museum and wondering, have they kind of come to meet you halfway on any of this stuff? Or are there any kind of processes happening there at the moment which would seek to kind of do more of that work that you've started and carried for, you know, years now?
Well, in the last like 2-3 weeks, they've appointed a Pacifica and Māori curator. which is a woman named Hatisa who's been at the museum for a really long time. She has a lot of knowledge, and so that, I think, is a step. There's no plans to have any of it out. They want to redevelop the museum. A number of museum staff have said the only way that it will eventuate is if the community keep asking for it. So, you know, I guess you just keep asking and see what happens. Being very fortunate and having really good relationships with people at the museum and with the director, he's been very supportive of my work in the past. And you really do see that over the last couple of years, first it was like, oh no, we can never have these things out of here. What do you mean you want to have these out of here, you know? And then it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I suppose you can have a few. And I think now they've got some going into Shirley Boys High School for a little bit. So, you know, there's more conversations about getting it out, which is great. But there's no long-term plan that I know of.
Yeah. Do you know what is holding it back, like keeping those things?
Money.
Money. And like
money and what people think is important.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you think about that, but it's very backward. You know, they've only just decided to get rid of those. What are those things?
The dioramas.
Yeah, the dioramas, you know. But people have been asking for that for ages and actively asking for it.
Just wanted to talk through you talked about materiality and kind of the choices you've made. There's a list on the worksheet if you have it that lists them all. Walking stick, high-vis, plastic sticks, ribbon, zip ties, spray paints, wire, Fimo, fibrous woven mats, plastic bags, sequins, picture hang cord, nail polish, weed mat, nylon rope, feathers, plastic heads, shells, fabric, tevive, cotton, tapa, bubble wrap, wool, automotive paint, ribbon, duct tape, colonial banisters, lampstand, thyme, and glue. And I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, especially like the tangaroa at the head of the stick, the anina.
Well, I started trying to recreate a lot of these items without having like 20 years under my belt of carving. That was just not going to happen in 3 months. So I started looking for items. I thought and I came across, you know, I'm a big trader. I've got some issues. I actually think that if you put things on your watch list, it kind of alleviates the need to buy things. Because you're just collecting the images of the beautiful things. And part of my search is there's always Pacifica, Samoa, you know, like everything's broken down and have these searches that are happening every day. Because there are so many of our items that are just out there that no one knows that what they have. And so a lot of things I get from people that don't know what they have and they're just selling it off thinking that they've got some kind of, oh, this is Samoan, I think. And so I have these constant watch lists going on. Cook Island items, I look for them all the time, and I stumbled across a tangaroa. Now the god stick itself would be tangaroas, be a line of tangaroas that would kind of move into the next one, and it would get smaller in the head of the tangaroa. So I was just really like, it just felt like it was just meant to be. And he was actually a lamp. He was the bottom of a lamp and pulling up him, and he was a torosa. The particular design looks like it's from the late 70s. They had a lot of these lamps going around in this particular design. And so I found him on Travi and he was a lamp, and I went into a mean bidding war with somebody else. I was victorious. And he became the centre of it all, really. I had him for a long time and wondered what to do with him. And then decided I would bling him on up. The end of the stick was put on Travi as a Tongan talking stick. which I thought was really interesting because I'd never heard about any Tongan talking sticks before. Couldn't find a lot of information about Tongan talking sticks. And on the back of it is carved Tonga 2002. But the designs look clearly like Hawaiian, not Tongan. And ask people in the community, you know, is this Tongan? And then you turn it and they go, oh, no, you know, oh, and then you turn it around and say, oh, it's this, oh, yeah, must be. But that was really an interesting item to me and how it had been listed. You know, like, if you don't get the information passed down, then whatever people give you is what you think is happening. But the designs look Hawaiian to me, anyway. And, you know, being a magpie, my studio is full of just, like, buckets of beads and buckets of feathers and buckets of things. And a lot of that has come from people asking me to make them things. Like, can you make me a kuinga? Can you make me a this and that? And I always feel like it's not my place to do that. You know, like, kuinga's a Samoan headdress and I'm not Samoan and I know these things. There's a history there. I don't pretend to know about it. But what do you do if they're saying, well, no one's going to make one for me and I really want one for my kid or this and that and this? And it's like, well, you need to realise that this is not my place, but I'll do it. And I have a lot of those experiences where I end up getting a lot of the stuff. And so it just seemed that it was natural to use it because I have it all.
Are there any questions for Nina? The floor.
I'm just wondering what goes on inside the.
So this is hundreds of meters of things that's been wrapped individually, and you know, I'll let you stay with it if they move all the way through. And in here we've got a Tongan tapa. Got some plastic bags, weed mat, lots of weed mat. Plastic fellas, fibrous fellas, mats, there's feathers in there, there's a few secret things in here that remain secret. Bubble wrap, and you know, it took a really long time to try and figure that out.
When you say hundreds of meters, was this something that was fixed into one long length, or is it lots of lengths bound?
The weed mat was all done in one length. There's like 200 metres or something of weed mat. The bubble wrap and stuff was done in lengths. The other things were done with more care. But we just tried as much as possible to get as much in there, really. That was because you'd have the hundreds of metres. And then in the middle of it is a beautiful wooden pole that has some secrets around it too. Yeah.
Can't blame it, kia ora. You get a feeling there's something going on in there, you really do.
Yeah, interesting last night because lots of people were like, oh, so can we unwrap it? So you can unwrap it. We're never putting it back together again. But no, you can't. There's lots of things in there that are just for what's going on in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any questions?
Yeah, thank you so much again for your work and thanks for your time today.
That was Nina Oberg Humphreys discussing her exhibition Ta'ai. Come in and see the exhibition in the gallery at 301 Montreal Street, which is on until Sunday, 29th November. We now have an audio described tour of Ta'ai written and presented by Judith Jones.
Kia ora, I'm Judith Jones. This is an audio description of Ta'ai by Nina Oberg Humphreys at the Physics Room, Christchurch 2020. The Physics Room is two small rectangular galleries side by side. The shared long edge on the right has an opening towards the end furthest from where we arrive. This exhibition has three works, Ta'ai God Staff, Ta'ai Feather Gods, Ta'ai Single Channel Video. We enter the gallery from the street past a small welcome area. The galleries are framed by walls painted a rich, dark, matte blue, a colour called Submerge, chosen by the artist. The two 3D works are displayed in the first room. I will describe one on a rectangular plinth just ahead to our right, then a set of five pieces hung along a wall to our left. Nina also designed the lighting. Spots from above highlight the displays and leave semi-darkness around them. The warm brown Rimu floor at times reflects the light. The room sheet lists these materials: walking stick, high-vis, plastic, sticks, ribbon, zip ties, spray paints, wire, Fimo, fibrous woven mats, plastic bags, sequins, picture hanging cord, nail polish, weed mat, nylon rope, feathers, plastic heads, shells, fabric, tivaivai, cotton, tapa, bubble wrap, wool, automotive paint, ribbon, duct tape, colonial banisters, lampstand, whis, thyme, glue. The plinth, also submerged blue, is 5 meters long, 60 centimeters wide, and 60 centimeters high. It holds Ta'ai, God Staff. Four spotlights along the ceiling illuminate the cylindrical work as it lies, taking almost the full length of the plinth. We will walk through the middle of the room with this alongside us on our right. Its outer layer is matte black weed cloth. There are layers of other materials wrapped inside this. At the end we first encounter, it's about 120 centimeters around. I suspect I could barely touch my fingertips to each other if I were to put my arms around it here. At regular intervals, the work is wrapped by bands of black nylon rope, 8 to 10 side by side, even rope wraps of its girth, 13 bands along it, securing it in place. The roll tapers in gradually towards the other end, perhaps indicating there's less bound inside there. The open end facing us offers a glimpse of what is inside, some of what is inside anyway. Materials have been folded and rolled within it, within each other, layer on layer. Only their edges here give us a sense of what lies within. Brown tapa cloth, a plastic carrier bag, something high-vis, bright orange with a silver stripe, pink and yellow patterned cotton fabric, a fluff of red and black woolen tassels. The end of a carved, red, painted walking stick juts out 50 centimetres from the inner layer of wrap. It has a smooth end for holding, then carved sections like a string of wide, variously shaped beads, silhouetted against the plinth below. The red paint is the automotive paint in the materials list. The light bounces off its curves and angles and off the glittery nail polish that coats it. At the other end of the work, a glittery red rectangular carving emerges from the inner layers of the wrap. The materials inside are rolled tighter here. The ends are deeper inside. It's harder to make out what they are. This carving was the base of a table lamp. Nina found this on Trade Me, as she explains in her artist talk. It's a human figure in a squatting stance with flexed legs and hands resting on its stomach, its feet above the opening of the roll. Its head is about a third of its body with large eyes and mouth and casts a solid shadow beneath it. The artist says, "I decided I would bling him on up. There are sequins over the skin of its face and bright red feathers fluff out around it. Strings of bright yellow and red beads, larger ones shaped like buds and open flowers, thread across the plinth top alongside the figure." Ta'ai Feather Gods 2020 is a set of five wall-mounted works. Against the dark blue wall, spotlit from above, these pop with bright colour and an array of materials and textures. The base layer of each is a colonial banister, around 110 centimetres long, with a rectangular form at the bottom, about a metre off the ground. The artist has wrapped each of these with a mix of materials. One is topped with almost a bouquet of dark red feathers. Below these, a section of the wood has been wrapped with stripes of black and yellow cotton, thread by thread set alongside each other. This wrap, meticulous in its spacing and tension, is used on the others with different colours, different dimensions. This form then has a downward flare of orangey artificial fibre. This mix of natural and created materials is a feature of them all. Below this, green and yellow Pacifica pattern fabric is wrapped around the base with four evenly spaced bands of cotton thread. Its rectangular base is covered with a wrap of thin yellow ribbon. Another dangles tassels that end with the orange fibre, cords with shells and beads, over a cotton thread wrap of blue and white above a flare of orange feathers. While the feathers flurry and flounce and beads dangle and reflect the light, there are also less obvious materials in this work. Short sticks wrapped with thread are bound into three of the forms. Turning 180 degrees from the feather gods, we're in front of the opening between the galleries, an invitation to travel further within the walls of blue. At the far end of the second space, there is the third work, Ta'ai Single Channel Digital Video 2020. This is a silent work. With the door open, there is some street noise in these spaces, but here, also the steady whir of the projector on the roof above us. A screen takes up the width of the wall, just over 3 metres wide. It's 1.8 metres high, starting about 25 centimetres up from the floor. Light from this at times reflects off the varnished boards, casting a pool of light, reflecting shapes and movement. The video is almost 6.5 minutes long and plays on a loop. I'll describe it as if it has just started, and then the visual aspects and narrative sequence, that is, not moment by moment in time. Three figures stand in darkness, facing us, similar height, but with the middle figure closest to us, not fully sized, but fully present with us in the space. In the centre, a young Pacific man stands, bare feet apart, open chest. He's draped in a black cloth from his waist to below his knees. Light shines from above onto his bare chest and arms and almost sparkles off the sheen of the cloth. His head inclines slightly upwards. The light shines onto his brow beneath his short dark hair. He blinks, his chest moves to his breath. Flanking him, almost shrouded in darkness, two young Pacific women also stand still. They are draped in the same black fabric from beneath their arms to below their knees. The fabric almost merges with the dense black background. Dim light reflects from their faces, bare shoulders, arms and legs. The woman on the right moves out of frame. After a moment, she returns, bringing a roll of tapa. She holds it vertically with both hands, its lower edge to the ground. She can just reach to touch the top of it when it is set down. The tapa has black and brown geometric patterns on both sides. She sets it behind the young man, and her female companion joins her, moving into the light that shines on her short, light-coloured hair, tied up behind her head. She now takes hold of the roll while the other woman continues to hold one open end. She then starts to walk forward with the roll, unfurling the fabric, which she then wraps around the young man, creating a new roll. She circles around him. He stands still, looking ahead. The tapa slowly envelops him. As she reaches back to the beginning of her rotation, she and her companion steady the tapa. The young man's bare toes show under its lower edge. She stays behind him while her companion now moves to create a second wrap. As this young woman moves into the light, it shines on her long, dark hair falling in waves down her back. This time, the second circle completed, the young man's toes are covered. The women take turns to rotate and wrap, to wait behind and hold. Each handles the tapa as if she knows its properties, when and how it needs support. Sometimes they tug or jump it a little to keep the wrap firm and even. Once again, just for a moment, the bare toes of the young man are revealed. He hasn't moved his feet. Four times a woman unrolls and rewraps the tapa until they reach its end. The woman with short hair walks off to the right, while the other smooths and flattens the end of the cloth against the wrap on the left and waits. The tall cylindrical tapa form is a little wider than the shoulders of the young man within it. It moves, a slight shift, led from the inside. The short-haired woman returns with a coil of firm, dark rope, drooped in soft loops around her left hand. She moves behind the tapa and gently hands the end of the rope to her companion, then emerges again from the right. Her right hand takes the lead as she circles, pulls the rope around the tapa at about waist height. As she reaches her companion, they both move behind the form, stand close, pull the rope in tightly, perhaps knotting it in place. The light catches bare skin on an arm, an elbow, a lower leg. The woman with long hair walks off to the right. Her companion re-emerges, holding the rope, begins pulling it around again. She stops, judges, tugs it firm, and moves back behind the figure. She continues to circle close around the form, watching her hand, feeling and correcting the tension as the rope creates a pattern of dark lines across the tapa, resets its cylindrical shape within this binding that clenches it in as she pulls. For 25 rotations, the woman threads the rope across the form. She leans to set this dark line through a lower plane and then deeper to wrap lower still. As she pulls it firm, sometimes feet and toes show beneath. The edge of the fabric flares out a little, revealing the white underside. The next wraps scoop it back in. The tapa is dragged inwards by the pulling lines of rope, and when she pulls tight, the shape within it is revealed a little. Sometimes the wrapped form responds with a slight tilt, a wobble, a rebalance. She reaches high, the line stretches and holds fast around the shoulders, the neck, over the top of where the young man's head would be. Rotation 25, moving from right to left, the young woman stops behind the tapa, perhaps making a knot to hold the rope. The light catches an arm, an elbow. She walks away to the right. The bound tapa stands. It has lost its tall cylindrical shape. It is crisscrossed with black lines. The tension of the rope draws it in, fabric bulges and bends. Its form reveals now more of the form within. It stands, not quite still. The screen fades into darkness.
Thank you for listening, and tune in next month on Friday, 18th of December at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art, Not Science. Nga te wā!
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, Resine Paints, and the Crater Rim.